All right, you guys, welcome to the show. How's it going? I'm Scott Horton. Welcome to the show. It's the Scott Horton Show. Libertarian foreign policy, mostly. Meaning, you know, opposition to it. Attempts to discredit and debunk. And right now it looks like a bunch of maybe hostages are being rescued or people are running or maybe it's file footage, I don't know. Terrorist attack in Tunisia on a museum there. I don't know if they claim they're affiliated with this or that group yet. Bunch of people running on CNN International. Run! They're running for their lives, the people on CNN International. The, Tunisia. That's really the one success story of the Arab Spring as far as people power is concerned, where they got rid of their dictator and they held some elections. And then they held some more elections, and the guys who had won last time lost the next time. And instead of going to war, they respected that and stepped aside. Looks like, they're trying. Anyway, we'll have more about that later on in the show. Just thought you'd like to know what I'm looking at on CNN, you know. All right. Now, I got a couple of invites out, but I don't know if I'm hearing back from people or what, man. But that's all right, because I've got plenty of explaining and complaining to do on my own. Wasn't sure which to say first. That's why the long pause there. Explaining. Anyway, let's talk about the Israeli elections. So Netanyahu's group cleaned up. I guess I should have the... That's the Likud party. I should have all the numbers in front of me somewhere, but I don't. But you don't care about me reciting all the numbers. The point is that Netanyahu's party, Likud, came in first. And then in second place is the Zionist Union, a.k.a. the Labor Party, a.k.a. Zippy Livni, and what's his name? The guy whose name I forget all of a sudden. Doesn't matter. Anyway, and then in third place, you have the Arab List, which is a coalition of all the different Arab-Israeli groups. Of course, again, not from the occupied territories. They have no vote. But these are the Israeli citizens, Christian and Muslim Arab-Israeli citizens. And they have their coalition, and they're in third. Get back to that in just a second. And then you got... I forget the guy's name, but doesn't matter as much. And then in fifth place, very importantly, in fifth place, you have this guy Moshe Kalan from the Kalanu Party, which is a brand new party, and I believe he is a breakoff from Netanyahu's Likud. And I think maybe he's the guy who's supported by Michael Oren, the former Israeli ambassador to the United States. I think. Anyway, so here's the thing about that. Is that the president of Israel is a guy named Rivlin, and Rivlin has already said he wants basically a coalition government of Likud and Labor, the guys in first and second place, which seems like a possibility, except that would leave the Arab List as the leaders of the official opposition in the Knesset, which, I don't know, really, but I was reading Bilmon on Twitter, and that guy Bilmon seems to be pretty much right about everything for a decade straight. I mean, he's a liberal of some kind, but when it comes to his foreign policy analysis, he's really, you know, spot on here. And he was saying, well, that means that they would have to get all the top secret intelligence briefings and all this kind of thing. They would have to be included in the functioning of the government in certain ways that they're excluded from now. If they were the official opposition, that might be enough to kill a coalition of Likud and Labor right there. And then, but then the other thing is, this guy, Moshe Kalan from the Kalanu Party, he's, even though he's only in fifth place, and his group's only in fifth place, they're not already sworn to support this or that other side. The Arab List, for example, has already sworn to support Labor, the Zionist Union Party. Imagine that, the Arabs supporting the Zionist Union Party. Anybody but Likud. Anybody but Bush for them. Anybody but Netanyahu. And, but so that leaves this guy, Moshe Kalan, as the kingmaker, they're saying. And he could actually, even though Netanyahu is pretty far out ahead and further out ahead than apparently was expected or predicted by the exit polls, or anything like that, or even the, you know, the polls leading up to the thing. Apparently this guy, Kalanu, could, Kalan from the Kulanu party, he could actually make a deal with the Zionist Union that would put Herzog, the guy whose name I forgot a minute ago, and make him the prime minister, even though Netanyahu is out ahead at this point. So it's really not a done deal. Netanyahu has claimed victory prematurely. But it's good PR for him. And he did win by quite a bit more than was anticipated. But he didn't win by such a degree that nobody else has a say in the thing. And, you know, I'm trying to remember. I did see somewhere that Avigdor Lieberman's party, Yisrael Betanu, actually did fairly poorly in this thing. He's the guy who was saying disloyal Arabs ought to have their heads chopped off with axes. Yisrael Betanu, they got 6 seats. Meretz 4. Likud, so top to bottom then. Likud 30. Zionist Union, a.k.a. Labor, 24. And the United Arab List, 13. Kalanu, 10. Yesh Atid is the party that is in 4th place here. And then the ultra-right-wing and Orthodox are at 8 and 7. Anyway, so the point being that it's not really wrapped up for Netanyahu yet, although probably it is. There's some wrinkles in there. Very interesting. And now, I think you can tell by the way I explain all that, there's plenty of disclaimer built in. I'm certainly not an expert on either electoral politics or Israeli electoral politics, but I've been trying to read as much as I can. And I did talk with Eric Garris, and he is not an expert on Israeli politics, but he is an expert on electoral politics and who has how many numbers and what kind of options that leaves open for them and that kind of thing, right? He's the kind of guy that can show up at a Libertarian Party convention and somehow trick you into voting for the guy that you hate. he's just talented like that. So he was explaining it to me a little bit. But again, disclaimers. But yeah, sure looks like Netanyahu's still maybe, probably. Which is a bummer. And you know, I don't know, this guy Herzog, somebody had published the other day a map of the West Bank, a Palestinian state, under the plan of the Zionist Union, the Herzog plan, basically, for the two-state solution. And it's a complete joke. You know, you got nearly half of the thing is the security zone, Area C, between the Jordan River and, I guess, Hebron, whatever, I don't know. Anyway, it's a joke. These guys are, you know, they're the Obama to Netanyahu's Bush. In other words, the empire with a nicer face on it. So, you know, I don't know. I'm seeing that's a big debate between liberal Zionists and people who want a secular single state. That some people are saying it's better with Netanyahu, better with Bush. It just helps discredit the whole project. And the real answer is, like Netanyahu says, there will never be a Palestinian state. So it's time to make the whole thing one state. And little d democracy for everybody. Which, you know, we'll see.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.
All right, you guys. Welcome back. I'm Scott. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Talking now about Netanyahu and the Israeli elections yesterday. So, yeah. One of the things that happened in the lead up to this thing is that Netanyahu was so desperate to win re-election that he deployed what the chat room calls the Southern Strategy. Nixon's Southern Strategy. Appeal to the baser instincts of the right. And so he fear-mongered that the Arabs are coming out in droves. Again, not the people of East Jerusalem, the West Bank, the Gaza Strip. They don't get to vote. But the Israeli Arabs. The Arabs are coming out in droves. They're going to take over the country if we don't stop them, everybody. It's the Mexicans. It's the blacks. They're coming for us, said the Republicans. The Israeli version. So anyway, it worked. And to be specific, what he really said was, we're going to steal all their land. The West Bank belongs to us. In so many words, there'll never be a two-state solution. What he ended up admitting was that he never supported a Palestinian state. He was lying all along, just like in that hidden video where he talks about how he screwed Bill Clinton right in the face in the year 2000. Oh, the Americans? Yeah, don't worry about them. They're easily moved. It's absurd. 80% of the American people support us. It's absurd, Netanyahu said. But the question was, well, geez, Netanyahu, if you screw the president of the United States right in the face like that, might you get us in trouble and get them pissed off at us? And his answer was, yeah, we don't have to worry about that. In fact, the joke is, you should watch that video. It's great. It's got all the subtitles. He's speaking Hebrew, but it's got all the subtitles on there for you. And what he's saying is that, yeah, so I told Bill Clinton, well, sure, we just need to be able to keep control of Area C for security purposes, these security zones in the West Bank. And so Bill said, okay, that sounds reasonable. And then so we made Area C half the damn West Bank. Ha 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 ha. This is how we justify stealing land. We just say that we're not, and then we do it. And so that's all he's doing now. Well, now what he's doing is he's admitting again, just like on that hidden camera, now he's admitting openly that, yeah, we're not giving up the West Bank. Did I say we would negotiate a Palestinian state and that the only hang-up was the other side were the dishonest part of the negotiations and there's no point in dealing with them? Is that what I said? Nah, that was all lies. And everybody who believed it, a damn fool. But right now, there's an election at stake, and so, blam, he tells the truth. But so where does that leave all the European capitals whose populations insist on an eventual Palestinian state and whose governments tell their populations, oh yeah, no, really, we're working on that. Now, the Americans, not so much, but the Americans do have to deal with the rest of the world. The American people don't know the first thing about it, really. And if they do, they're horrible on it. For the most part. It's absurd how easily moved Americans are, to tell you the truth. But what does this mean for the future of United Nations? I don't know. Probably nothing. American vetoes. You know, come to think of it, why do the Americans try in any way? Why would Kerry or Obama go out on a limb at all to try to push for a Palestinian state the way that they have? I mean, not that they tried that hard. Remember, Andrew Coburn came on the show and said, oh, yeah, no, he knows people who know Obama who are working on this thing, and their attitude is he's not going to support these negotiations if John F., we know what F stands for, Kerry, is going to get the credit for it. Not on Obama's watch. And so Obama never really gave Kerry the support that he needed. But Obama, at least rhetorically, has gone out on a limb, you know, over this a few times. You got to wonder why. Why even bother, really? I don't know. I think things are going to change in Europe, politically speaking, about this. You know, the deal was, Netanyahu, you have to keep saying that you want a Palestinian state. You just have, you can go ahead and continue not ever agreeing to one. But you have to at least say that's what you want to see someday. That was kind of the bargain, I think. And then here's the thing, right? I saw Kenneth Roth from Human Rights Watch say, well, geez, if a Palestinian state isn't the answer, then what is the answer? Well, obviously, ethnic cleansing. And, you know, continued oppression for some and ethnic cleansing for others and the continued expansion of the settlements. As it says here at antiwar.com from yesterday or from 2 days ago, Netanyahu vows tens of thousands of new settlement homes if reelected. Colonies on other people's land. That's what they mean, on stolen land. And I don't mean stolen back in 48. I mean being stolen in slow motion since 67 this whole time. And yeah, that's how you can tell a conservative from a libertarian. A libertarian believes that Palestinians have property rights. A conservative doesn't believe that. A conservative doesn't really know what a right is. To a conservative, a right is just what they want, right? That's all. But to a libertarian, Palestinians are human beings and they own property, and then therefore it's a crime to deprive them of their property. It's pretty much as simple as that. And you know what? Here's also what it's as simple as. What if the Palestinians had been winning all the wars lately and they had herded all the Jews into the concentration camp of the Gaza Strip, made it a prison, put them under siege on a siege that it said in the Palestinian documents were meant to keep the Jewish Israelis hungry, but not starving, just on a diet, then would that be okay? Right, no, gee whiz. You mean if those Palestinian subhumans treated the Jewish, I don't know, superhumans the way that they've been treated all this time? Why, ha! We might have a moral objection to that. Yeah, well, there you go. It's fun to play these little thought experiments. But so that's what Netanyahu means. That's what Likud means when they say no Palestinian state. They mean an Israeli state all the way to the Jordan River. Greater Israel. Grand theft land. And all the people who live there, they can go rot in the Gaza concentration camp, I guess. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders, quotes, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support The Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
All right, guys, welcome back. A couple of things here. The Kickstarter was a tremendous success. We got 200% and a little more than that of what we were asking. Thank you so much, everybody, for that. I really appreciate it. It's all going to very good use. I got a guy who got a guy who's a level million computer genius dude who's going to make all this possible. This being the scraping of all 3,600 interviews, 100 plus interviews, all their titles and dates and descriptions and things, and putting them all up on YouTube in video format. And it's going to be a complicated process, making sure, first of all, that everything is there, and then doing all the conversion automatically and making it all happen and doing it all in order, because YouTube doesn't let you drag and drop the order. You got to do it in order. And I don't know. I hope it's good. I think it's going to work. It's going to be great. And then because you guys donated that much more, I'm going to see if I can get them to put it all on SoundCloud too, because I think then more people can find it there. We put it there, too? I don't know. In any case, it's all going back into the show, and anything left over from, you know, obvious projects like that that I can use this guy for will go to the new servers. And Sneaker says we need two new servers, and that it's going to cost about $1,500 for the two of them, $1,400, something like that, for the two of them. So that's going to be a different Kickstarter, and that's going to be, I don't know, in another few weeks or a month or something. I guess we need to get this project pretty much, I don't know, I guess we could do them both at the same time. Anyway, we'll see about that. But first of all, thank you very much, everybody donated to the Kickstarter for this project. I appreciate it. I've been looking forward to having it this way for a long time, but I didn't know how I was ever going to do it. But now I got a guy who got a guy who can do it. Yeah. All right, cool. All right, secondly, join up the chat room if you want. There's the chat room. I'm live here noon to 2 Eastern time on the Liberty Radio Network, and during that time I'm in there. Sometimes I'm in there a little more often than that. I used to hang out quite a bit more than that. Anyway, drop by the chat room, man. See us in there during the show. Make a comment. See if I knows it. Usually I try to keep up the whole show long. Alright, cool. And now, Oh, Giraldi, 1:30. Cool. All right, cool. Giraldi's going to be on at 1:30. So we'll have an interview. So cool. I mean, this is the stuff I'm going to ask him about anyway. But so check this out, man. I just saw on the Twitter there. It's Ali Abunama. He's from the electronicintifada.net, Palestinian-American activist. And this article is called Why I'm Relieved Netanyahu Won. Huh? Didn't Scott Horton just say that when Netanyahu says no two-state solution, what he really means is he's going to steal the whole damn West Bank and Palestinians can't have it? Why would Ali Abunama be relieved about that? Well, I'll read it to you what he says. It's quite clear and to the point, I think. Many had hoped that Benjamin Netanyahu would be defeated in yesterday's Israeli election. I was not one of them. Many had already written him off. Pre-election polls showed his Likud party lagging behind the allegedly center-left Zionist Union, headed by Yitzhak Herzog and Zippy Livni. But I kept in mind the 1996 election, where Netanyahu was universally thought to be the loser well after the votes had been cast. In the wake of the assassination of Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, it had been expected that his supposedly dovish successor Shimon Peres, who had launched a bloody invasion of Lebanon months earlier in the hopes of proving to the electorate his tough security credentials, would easily win. But on that election night, Netanyahu told his supporters, "The hour is still early, and the night is long." I wonder if he had Karl Rove over there working for him, helping count those votes, or what. As the votes were counted, that was me right there, sorry, the Karl Rove bit. Ali Abunama writes, as the votes were counted, he pulled ahead, beating Peres and securing his first term as prime minister. Netanyahu did it again on Tuesday. With virtually all the votes counted, Likud has 30 seats, the Zionist Union has 24, and the joint list of predominantly Arab parties is in third place with 14. it seems all but certain that Netanyahu will retain his post as Israel's prime minister and head another fanatically right-wing government. Truth in labeling. Let me be clear, Abunima writes. I'm not happy that Netanyahu won as such. Netanyahu is a blood-soaked killer. He should be put on trial for his many crimes, from the relentless theft of Palestinian land to last summer's massacre in Gaza, and I yearn to see that day. But reveling in the murder of Palestinians and calling it self-defense barely distinguishes him from his rivals. Livni, a fugitive war crimes suspect, was one of the proud and unrepentant architects of Israel's massacre in Gaza in 2008 and 2009 that undoubtedly served as Netanyahu's model. Her partner Herzog has faulted Netanyahu for not attacking Gaza viciously enough. Netanyahu's ugly election day incitement that the Arabs are advancing on the ballot boxes. That guy is such a crank. Are you kidding me? Sorry. Revealed once again his true feelings that Palestinian citizens of Israel are not legitimate citizens deserving full rights. But Zippy Livni has frequently expressed the same view. I'm sorry, I gotta stop and behold that for just one more moment here. Arabs are advancing on the ballot boxes like it's an army of invaders, of foreigners invading to conquer. What are they gonna do with the ballot boxes? Steal them and stuff them? No, they're gonna vote in them. You know, it's their local precinct election headquarters. It's their right. Benjamin Netanyahu. What a jerk. And while he is absolutely committed to the theft and colonization of occupied Palestinian land, Abunima continues, that too does not distinguish Netanyahu from his ostensibly dovish predecessors. A recent interactive feature published by the New York Times shows that Israeli settlement construction in the occupied West Bank, excluding occupied Jerusalem, was often far higher under the supposed peace-seeking governments of Ehud Barak and Ehud Olmert. But what has distinguished Netanyahu is that he strips away the opportunities for the so-called international community to hide its complicity with Israel's ugly crimes behind a charade of a peace process. Moreover, Netanyahu's open alliance with the most racist, white supremacist, Islamophobic, and bigoted elements of the North American and European right, his speech to Congress earlier this month was a manifestation of this, place Israel in the correct ideological camp. Israel can no longer practice apartheid at home while falsely presenting itself as a beacon of liberalism around the world. In short, Netanyahu's re-election is like the nutrition facts label on a box of junk food. It tells you about the toxic ingredients inside. No Palestinian state. Netanyahu's clear declaration days before the vote that he will not allow a Palestinian state was simply an affirmation of the real policy of every Israeli government since 1967, to which Herzog and Livni would have adhered. Herzog and Livni would not have permitted a Palestinian state worthy of the name. Rather, with international support, they would have attempted to draw Palestinians back into, quote, negotiations over what would almost be a ghetto-like Bantustan designed to legitimize Israel's theft of vast tracts of land, its annexation of Jerusalem, and its abrogation of the rights of Palestinian refugees. Herzog, he links then to Ben White's analysis of this horrifying plan for a permanent apartheid, which opened a new tab right there, sold. Herzog, too, had vowed to continue building settlements on stolen Palestinian land, but he would hide this expansionist policy behind one of the cosmetic and fraudulent freezes, during which colonization continues unabated. Had the Zionist Union won, there was a very grave danger that the Palestinians would have been dragged back into a decade of fruitless Oslo-style, quote, negotiations that would have served as a cover for continued subjugation and colonization. Such negotiations have provided the principal excuse for the so-called international community to endlessly defer holding Israel even minimally accountable. The refrain from gutless officials is always some version of, yes, isn't it terrible, but there's a peace process, and yeah, the peace process. And so anyway, so he says, step up BDS. I'm sorry, we're out of time for this segment. He says, so that's it. Now that reality is showing its naked face to you, go ahead and boycott the hell out of it. Three cheers for that. That's electronicintifada.net. In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. The entire process, from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people. The next of these great workshops is Saturday, April 11th in Las Vegas. It's just $15. For more information, go to taxpayersunited.org/govpensions. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Yeah, so go back, check the archives, and I bet you dollars to dimes. You can hear me talking about the rise of the Islamic State. All last spring, man, I was just paranoid as hell a year ago. I made it a point. I mean, well, I'm reading Patrick Cockburn all the time. You got to read everything he writes, right? But then I was also interviewing everybody else I know who knows anything about it. Ray and Phil. Phil's going to be on a little while too, by the way. Phil Giraldi. Jonathan Landay, and I brought Michael Scheuer back from the dead. Hadn't talked with him in a while. Brought Michael Scheuer back on. Basically just to shout my paranoias at him. Hey, Michael Scheuer. Hey, it seems to me like we're going to have to go back to war. Not have to, but quote unquote have to. Go back to war against the new Islamo-fascist caliphate that used to be a joke. That used to be the most ridiculous bit of Republican propaganda until they made it happen. And now look at what's going on here with this Syrian war. And he was saying, I think we're going to go to war in Nigeria, man. They got a lot more oil. We're dependent on that oil. That's a huge part of our imports, man. It's from Nigeria. And I says, yeah, but they're already, they've renamed Nusra and split off by then. He got the Islamic State, this group, they're calling themselves a state, and I was incorporating with the knowledge I already had that the Iraqi government really doesn't control Sunnistan very much anyway. We covered back in 2013 how Iraqi army forces were withdrawing from Mosul and from further flung places. We talked about that with Patrick Cockburn at the time. So it was that obvious. Here you got this group, they've got free run across the border there. And all the way to Baghdad, basically, where the Iraqi government barely has a presence in Sunnistan, the so-called Iraqi government, meaning the Shiite parties and their militias and so-called army that George Bush built for them. And so how long before it's, you know, actually a state and then we have a war again? Because then, boy, that'd be bad PR, huh? And you can go back and check the archives all last spring. This is my deal. I'm as paranoid as the worst warmonger claims to be, I guess, about the Islamic State. And in fact, I'm more paranoid than even Phil Giraldi and many others. He's not paranoid at all. I'm more paranoid even than some of the warmongers on the Islamic State attacking inside the United States. I mean, it can't be that easy for him to do. But then again, I don't know. They say thousands of Europeans have gone to Syria to fight for a while, and then how many of them have come home? Hundreds and hundreds? And how many of them, if they were really trying, could get a visa and get into the United States, because nobody's keeping that close a track? And then how easy is it to get a rifle and do something horrible for one of these guys? It doesn't take much. And you don't even have, any of them don't even necessarily have to go to Syria to fight, to learn, to train, to do it. In fact, the guys that did the Charlie Hebdo thing, oh no, I guess they said that one guy did go to Yemen, right? Anyway, and the reason why is because it makes sense to me that the Islamic State would want to attack the United States. That's why they cut those people's heads off and said, don't you dare come here and fight us, is because what they were really saying was, we dare you to come here and fight us. Because, well, I guess they figure all they got to do is not lose. And they've just been through a giant 5, 6, 7 year war with the Americans, and all they had to do was not lose, and they didn't lose. And they started off as almost nothing, Bin al-Tawid al, whatever the hell, Zarqawi's group. Ended up growing into this giant phenomenon. So, makes sense to me that they would do everything they can to get America to put ground forces there. Because it's in their interest to do it. But now you look at them where, you know, I don't know exactly how much money and who's sheiks and who all is backing who and what the real balance of power is. But the Islamic State, at least as flavor of the month now, getting sworn backers from all across Africa, they don't have to do anything except, you know, offer franchise rights. You know what I mean? Listen, when you cut their heads off, though, you gotta go from right to left. Those are the rules of how we do things here at Islamic State. And then these guys can set up their own little franchise in Africa, in Libya, in the Sinai Peninsula, wherever they want. And all they have to do is say that they're, you know, they don't need a real infrastructure, a real bureaucracy to do all this stuff, right? It's all just by email. All they have to do is claim to be part of the same organization, have more or less the same goals in mind, and they got a whole new project. The Americans have a whole new project. And what are they going to do about it? I don't know, and I don't think they know either. I think there's a lot of cognitive dissonance going on at the empire level here right now, where, you know, here Barack Obama actually, I don't have it queued up correctly, sorry, but the quote is, Obama was asked in an interview with Vice News, so what caused the Islamic State to come into existence? And Obama says, well, you know, two things. ISIL is a direct, I don't know why they insist on calling it ISIL instead of ISIS like everybody else. It kind of pisses me off. ISIL is a direct outgrowth of Al-Qaeda in Iraq that grew out of our invasion, he said. Which is an example of unintended consequences, which is why we should generally aim before we shoot. Yeah, says the author of the Afghan surge and the Pakistan and Yemen and Somalia war, drone wars and the Libya regime change against Gaddafi. And the guy who is admitting his own support for the Mujahideen in Syria in the western half of this war for the last 4 years. And, you know, what do you expect them to do? Well, you know, this is as much my fault as it is George Bush's. Well, that's the thing, is that's exactly the truth. It's 100% George W. Bush's fault, and it's 100% Obama's fault. Because it's responsibility, it's not a real math problem, it's a matter of quality. And so they can be equally to blame. And if Obama didn't want to go down in history as the guy who helped Al-Qaeda fight a civil war in Syria, then he shouldn't have done it. He could have easily said, I'm sorry. Well, I don't know how easily, but he could have said, especially if he gave a speech about it. He could have said, listen, the Israelis and the Turks and the Saudis and the Qataris, they all hate Assad. And you know what? I do too. On behalf of all victims of all fascist dictatorships everywhere, that guy's a real jerk. But, no. We are not going to back the Sunni-based insurgency, the Mujahideen rebellion, against Syria's Saddam. The lesson of the Iraq War was it was a bad move to abolish that secular fascist dictatorship and its secular army. And now look what we got. And it would be madness to now back our enemies from the last war in their next war. So, no. And I'm going to have to insist, Turkey, Saudi, Qatar, back off Assad. I hate him too. Everybody hates him too. But right now, we're not going to basically fight a war on behalf of our enemies. We're not going to let you either unless you want to be our enemy too. And that would have been the end of it. All Obama would have had to do is say, hey, Republicans, Democrats, you know, political people here at home, Bill Clinton and George W. Bush both paid Assad to torture and kill these guys. See if you can get them to deny it. Okay? Thank you. That's because when it comes down to it, not that we have to back a three-piece suit wearing clean-shaven chin wearing fascist, but we're certainly not going to back a Mujahideen bin Ladenite rebellion against him. Yeah, simple. He could have done that. And instead, you know what he did? He backed the Mujahideen. From the very beginning, it was so clear, and you can go back again, check the archives. It was so clear all this time that the Syrian rebellion was dominated by the al-Nusra Front, the Syrian veterans of al-Qaeda in Iraq. And then, you know, ISIS was just the split off from the more Iraq, predominantly Iraqi veterans of al-Qaeda in Iraq. And it was a split between Golani and Baghdadi about who was going to follow the orders. And that's where ISIS split off from Nusra. But anyway, now I get to my real point at the end of the segment, finally. Nobody has the power to destroy the Islamic State except for the United States of America. And, of course, parentheses, all America can do about it is turn them back into an insurgency. But there is no other army ready, willing, or able to get rid of them. And yet, politics says that they must be gotten rid of. So what do you think is going to happen? Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Hey, dang old Phil Draw is going to be here in a little while. Going to ask him about Israel, Palestine, Iran stuff. Let's see. Israel, Palestine, Iran. And then, oh, and I want to talk to them about this Syria stuff, too, here. Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah, man. So, listen, Tom Friedman wrote this thing today. It's so full of crap, this guy. You know, they say, I don't know who they is, but they do say that Tom Friedman is the most influential writer in America when it comes to public policy type stuff here. Writer for the New York Times, really? A guy who exhorted Americans to support the invasion of Iraq for a year and a half leading up to the war with the rest of them. Who later cited, interestingly enough, he was saying, well, we just had to kill some Arabs just to prove you can't mess with us or we'll really mess with you. That was his argument. But then in the way he explained it, he actually said, you know, it could have been Saudi Arabia, you know, where the princes actually paid for the damn thing. It could have been Pakistan, where General Mahmoud helped pay for the damn thing. Right? But no, we had to bomb somebody, so we went from Baghdad to Basra. And say, oh yeah, you don't like it, we'll bomb you. Actually said, suck on this. We told the Iraqis, this is the most influential public intellectual in America, Thomas Friedman. Tell him, suck on this. But of course, from Baghdad to Basra, virtually everybody was a Shia. They were all absolutely ideologically opposed to the bin Ladenites in every way. They are now known as the bin Ladenites' prey. Why Baghdad to Basra? Of all the random places, we could have hit a place where at least somebody was responsible for the attack, you know? And to some degree, huh? Nope. Anyway, he's very intellectual, Thomas Friedman. Also, he wrote a book about environmentalism and how your property should be regulated in order to conserve the environment while he married, and the reason he's a zillionaire is because he married a lady who inherited, I think, a company that just goes around bulldozing wildlife habitat and putting strip malls there. So he's sort of the world's worst hypocrite. That's all I'm trying to say. Anyway, there's so many things wrong with this thing, including he blames Hamas for starting the war last summer and the rest of this crap. But here's one thing he says. Have I ruined your morning yet? No? Give me a couple more paragraphs. Okay, so we learned to live with Iran on the edge of a bomb. But shouldn't we at least bomb the Islamic State to smithereens and help destroy this head-chopping menace? Now, I despise ISIS as much as anyone, but let me just toss out a different question. Should we be arming ISIS? Or let me ask that differently. Why are we, for the third time since 9/11, fighting a war on behalf of Iran? Only 'cause you said so, pal. In 2002, we destroyed Iran's main Sunni foe in Afghanistan, the Taliban. In 2003, we destroyed Iran's main Sunni foe in the Arab world, Saddam Hussein. Because Friedman said so again. But because we failed, oh no, that wasn't the problem. The problem was we failed to erect a self-sustaining pluralistic order, which could have been a durable counterbalance to Iran. You did the Iraq war he wanted, but you didn't do it the way he wanted, Margaret O'Sullivan. David Petraeus, you failed to create a self-sustaining pluralistic order, which could have been a durable counterbalance to Iran. Yeah, I wonder if that has anything to do with the supermajority of the Iraqi people, you know, from Baghdad to Basra, being Shiites, and the Sunnis, and in alliance with the Kurds, who are another 20% against the Sunnis, who are only 20. Huh? Eh? But then he says, so here ISIS, with all its awfulness, emerges as a homegrown Sunni Arab response to this crushing defeat of Sunni Arabism. Mixing the Ba'athists with the Al-Qaeda kooks, he says. Obviously, I abhor ISIS and don't want to see it spread or take over Iraq. I simply raise this question rhetorically because no one else is. Friedman still doesn't listen to this show, I guess. Why is it in our interest to destroy the last Sunni bulwark to a total Iranian takeover of Iraq? Because the Shiite militias now leading the fight against ISIS will rule better? Really? So anyway, yeah, he's right about that. Not that we should support the Islamic State, but or that we should be happy that they are holding the Iranians back. Or anything like that. But yeah, the Iranian-backed factions in Iraq are just as bad as ISIS. The Badr Brigade is just as bad as ISIS. They're just on the other side. And Iran's, you know, has been absolutely pernicious in every way in their influence in Iraq since before the Iraq War. They helped lie America into that war through Ahmed Chalabi. And they took full advantage. The thing of it is, they haven't had conquest on their mind. They haven't been trying to go ever since 2003. This is a big part of split inside the Shia United Iraqi Alliance. What was the United Iraqi Alliance was the Iranian parties didn't really want to rule over Mosul, Tikrit, and Ramadi and Fallujah and these predominantly Sunni cities. They wanted strong federalism, which means, meh, we don't really care what happens to the Sunnis. Let them go off on their own. We're taking all the land from Baghdad to Basra with the help of Bush and Rumsfeld and Gates and Petraeus. We're taking all of Baghdad. And then screw you guys. We're going home, basically was the Shiite policy. Now, Friedman is kind of right that what America's doing is helping the Iranian-backed and quite literally Iranian-backed and led Shiite militias and a.k.a. the whatever's left of the Iraqi army. And they're trying to conquer predominantly Sunni lands. And I think it's a big question if they ever do take Tikrit, for example, whether they'll ever give it back to the predominantly Sunni population that has fled from there during all this fighting. And the thing of it is, the more the Iranians win, especially the more they and their sock puppets in Iraq win with American help, the greater the future backlash is going to be. For example, just hypothetically, I'm not saying it would have been okay. I don't want to sound like Tom Friedman saying, oh, the war was great if you'd only done it my way or anything like that. But just for argument's sake, if they had gotten rid of Saddam Hussein and then immediately left, so that in that case, Baghdad was still a pretty much mixed Sunni-Shia city with a lot of neighborhoods, you know, very mixed here and there and that kind of thing, too. with the Shia parties in a much less advantageous position without the American Army and Marine Corps at their beck and call to be their servants, and Air Force too, and spies and everything else. Then they would have had that much more incentive. It's not a guarantee. It's a, you know, alternative past kind of thing. What do you call that? Counterfactual, you can't prove, but it seems like on the face of it, they would have had that much more incentive to cooperate with the Sunnis and to cut a deal with the Sunnis the way Muqtada al-Sadr wanted to do all that time in those early days, and denounced Iran for trying to split the country up. And there might not have even been a civil war. It was the presence of the Americans that made the civil war what it was, fighting on behalf of the Shiites. And so, so the thing of it is that that's what led to the creation of the Islamic State, was that they got the shaft so hard because of American cooperation with the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution and the Dawa Party and their Badr Brigade Army. Really, it's Skiri's Badr Brigade Army, Badr Corps, working on behalf of the Iranians. So it is absolutely wrong to back anyone on any side of this fight. Because all you're going to do is just make matters that much worse and further distort power in the region and create that much further backlash on down the road. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, you guys, so I'm sorry, so convoluted. All I'm trying to say is now's the perfect time to quit intervening, because there is nothing that can be done over there that is not outright taking the side of people who should not have their side taken. You know, they say there's one report here of one of the villages near to Crete that the Iraqi army and Shiite militias drove the Islamic State out of. And some of the people came home and were quoted saying, yeah, we hate those Islamic State guys. They're a bunch of jerks. But yeah, Shiite militia guys are pretty scary. And you see this over and over again in Patrick Coburn's reporting, too. The idea, and I don't know, maybe the equation wouldn't quite work out in the end. But it certainly seems indisputable, really, that as long as the Shiites are attacking the Badr Brigade and the Iraqi army and the Iranians and the Americans, their servants, are attacking them, people prefer the Islamic State to what they think will be the alternative. In the same way, that's why the Shiites rally together against the Islamic State. These guys are some scary guys. So, you know, war is the health of the very worst segments of society. The security forces. The fighters. The killers. And so, you know, obviously it raises the question. If the Shiite militias and the Iranians would just back off and let the people of Mosul and Fallujah and Ramadi and I guess whatever other supermajority Sunni cities out there in the west and northwest of the country, and just let them know that, you know what, you can have your independence. And that was really what Dawa and Skiri wanted all along anyway. You can have your independence. Develop whatever oil resources you want anyway. We can trade, but you can be Sunni Stan. We don't care. You probably ought to change your government since this guy Baghdadi is, you know, making everybody's life miserable and isolating you from the rest of the world. But otherwise, we're not coming for you. Yeah, maybe it would make it that much easier for the local Sunni population to stage an uprising against the Islamic State. Another so-called awakening, where the tribes take predominance and drive the pseudo-scholars, you know, back out of power. the same way it happened in 2006 and 7. Now, when I put that to Patrick Coburn, hey, man, how about instead of the outside powers, the surrounding powers, how about just the local Iraqi Sunnis handle this and they get rid of the Islamic State? And he says, no, man, they can't. The relative power, it just isn't there this time. It's just too different of a situation than 2006 and 7. But then he goes on to explain. Because, hey, who do you prefer, the Islamic State or the Bada Brigade that's going to come and put a power drill through your skull? You know, that was America's allies, not our enemies, that used the power drills, movie fans. By the way. So you ask the local Sunnis, you've been conquered by the Islamic State. Do you prefer them or do you prefer the Bada Brigade? They prefer the Islamic State. It's a hell of a choice to have to make. Doesn't mean they like the Islamic State. They hate it. But the same reason that in Syria, the Shiites and the Alawites and the Kurds and the Christians all support the fascist dictatorship there. Because it's protecting them from the Islamic State. Same reason Iraqi Shiites support the Shiite militias that are protecting them from the Islamic State. But the lines are pretty much drawn. I mean, that's the thing. I don't know. Maybe there could be a future war for Kirkuk, which is further out on the plain or whatever. But I don't know. What's America supposed to do? Our best allies, the Turks, are NATO allies since the end of World War II. Are backing the Islamic State all along, are letting fighters come from all over the world through Turkey to go to Syria and to Iraq to join up with these guys. They're certainly not going to use their army to crush them. And then this is what one of the things I'm going to ask Phil Giraldi about next is about the split in all the leaks going on about Syria policy right now. Rehabilitating Al-Qaeda, really? Oh, the al-Nusra Front, you know, what we're going to do is have them put out a YouTube that says that they don't like Zawahiri anymore, and then we can use them again. That's all it takes to launder al-Nusra, huh? At the same time that John Kerry saying, hey, well, maybe we should talk to Assad about keeping him in power. Really? I don't know. It's a damn mess, that's for sure, a bloody one. Oh, and by the way, and this didn't get covered on the show yet. I don't even know if I have the tab anymore. But there was a McClatchy story about the civilian deaths from all the air campaign in Syria. You know, we have troops on the ground in Iraq, but there's an air campaign going on in both countries. And they've been blowing up a lot of innocent people to death. I know that we're all raised to think that that doesn't matter. If you can't actually hear the bang or hear the children screaming as they bleed out or whatever, then you're not supposed to worry about it. Well, you know, by the time the particles of their burning flesh make it into my nose, it's just, you know, parts per billion and everything. I can barely even tell, Scott, so. Guess, you know, maybe if I really concentrate. Dead Syrian kids bombed by the American government. It happens, including they bombed a jail full of a bunch of people who, you know, the Americans would have claimed they were there to fight for, a bunch of people who were there for non-crimes, you know, maybe for the kind of things that get you arrested in New York City, but otherwise the kind of things that, you know, would be the definition of totalitarianism. Hey, you're wearing the wrong kind of clothes, off to jail with you, then America bombs the jail. Killed 50 innocent people, and that was in one shot, Roy Gutman reported anyway. And there's been a lot more civilian deaths than that, so. I know, it's, you know, George Carlin has a whole routine about that. I didn't learn until years later there really was an explosion that killed thousands and thousands of people in Pakistan. It was an American company's fault, that whole Union Carbide thing. But he says, you'll be cleaning up around the house, TV news on in the background. They say 6,000 people were killed in an explosion today. And you go, where? And they say, in Pakistan. And you say, screw Pakistan. That's too far away to be any fun. But, hey, a train derails in the neighborhood. And come on, Dave, let's go look at the bodies. Let's go look at the bodies. Chaos and carnage and disruption. It's so fun. Let's go see what we can see. Let's go rubberneck. But even when it's your own government exploding people to death, when it's on the far side of an ocean, meh, who can get too worked up about that, right? Might as well be on another planet to most of us, I guess. But really all you have to do is just barely use your imagination instead of thinking of Syria as a line on a map that you're looking at from a bird's eye view. It's just a place with people standing on it. And then you can wonder what it's like to get bombed to death by a cluster bomb and then imagine them in that circumstance and then maybe the slightest bit of empathy. Sympathy. But then again, hey, if it's North Americans killing them, then Jesus says that's all right. Or something.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out TheBumperSticker.com at TheBumperSticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold TheBumperSticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let TheBumperSticker.com help you get the word out. That's TheBumperSticker.com at TheBumperSticker.com. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. I got Phil Giraldi on the line. He's the executive director of the Council for the National Interest, writes for the American Conservative Magazine and UNZ.com. That's UNZ, UNZ.com, former CIA officer. How's it going, Phil?
Okay. I'm following, obviously, developments in Israel very closely. It's interesting what happened there.
Yeah, well, so break it down for us. What do you think, in order of importance here?
Well, it's assuming that Netanyahu can pull together a coalition, which is by no means a given. It's clear that the Israeli government has moved considerably to the right. Netanyahu's appeal on the last couple of days was essentially racist and irredentist, and basically he's saying that there will be no Palestinian state, that we will not negotiate with them, and that he got out his votes by making the racist appeal that if the Jewish Israelis didn't vote for him, there were going to be a lot of Arabs coming to the poll. So it's moved considerably to the right, and I think this is something that will have consequences.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's interesting. First of all, about that racist appeal, pretty blatant there. And I guess not too worried about the long-term trade-off for, first of all, just how ugly it looks, saying, oh, the Arabs are going to march on the ballot boxes. Come on. Yeah, pretty bad, especially in these PC times. It's about, if he said that on Twitter, he'd be ruined. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, basically, he was, and of course, for the listeners, the Arabs he's talking about were the Arabs who are Israeli citizens and have been Israeli citizens since 1948. He was saying, don't let them vote, or don't, if they try to vote, we have to do something about it.
Right, yeah, exactly. Never even mind the people of the occupied territories who don't get to vote at all in this so-called democracy. But yeah, these are the people who, at least in theory, have just as much right to vote as any Jewish Israeli does.
Yeah, that's correct. So basically, this is like like a politician today in the United States saying, "Well, guys, you have to get out and vote because otherwise the blacks are going to vote, and we don't want that, do we?" So it's that racist and it's that unacceptable, and I think this is what when I talk about consequences, I think that Netanyahu is not going to be able to backtrack on this, not be able to walk away from it.
Yeah. Well,
and the fact that he's saying no Palestinian state ever, and no negotiations with them ever, essentially puts him into a corner, which I think a lot of Europeans initially. And eventually, I hope, Americans will find unacceptable.
Yeah, see, that's the real thing about it is, the racist stuff, you know, for the apologists, they'll figure out a way to say, oh, that's just politics or whatever, and move past that somehow. I know TV in America won't make a big deal out of it, certainly, that kind of thing. But the ultimate renunciation of the two-state solution, that seems to be a real problem. As I was reading Ali Abunama earlier, and he put it perfectly about how this is how the Americans and the Europeans continue to allow the Israelis to get away with what they're doing, is everybody agrees that they're not doing what they're doing, that they're working on a peace process, that they're going to solve this someday, that there's going to be a Palestinian state someday. So when you outright say that's never going to happen, it's not that it ever was going to happen. It's just that now he's completely blown the cover of the Americans and the Europeans for cooperating on this thing.
Yeah, that's right. It's going to become increasingly difficult, certainly for European politicians, to have anything to do with Israel in kind of a collaborative way. And, of course, it's going to be more difficult to reach that point here in the United States. Like Tom Cotton already came out today, and I'm sure you saw it, and he announced that he was really delighted that there will not be any Palestinian state. So, you know, there are plenty of apologists for Israel in the U.S. Congress primarily, but I don't think this is going to go over even very well in the media.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I guess remains to be seen whether they're even going to discuss it here. But, yeah, in Europe, certainly the politics over there, the populations of Britain, France, and Germany, this has got to be some kind of last straw for them, because they actually understand the situation in a way that Americans certainly don't.
Yeah, that's correct. And essentially, you know, you might minimize that. You say, okay, all Israel really needs is the United States to protect it in international bodies, to keep sending it money, to sell it weapons, to provide other forms of support. But the reality is that a lot of the Israeli economy is dependent on trade with Europe, and that can be adjusted very quickly. I mean, there could be something like sanctions Europeans will impose on Israel in various economic sectors. So, I mean, this is not an empty issue.
Right, and now so let's backtrack a little bit to the election results, because I guess, you know, Netanyahu did better than a lot of people said he would, and yet some reporting is still that the guy, Moshe Kalan, who's in fifth place, he hasn't pledged to either side yet. And with the Arab List in third place, it's conceivable that Kalan could be the kingmaker and make a deal with Labor or the Zionist Union and the Arab List, and then Netanyahu wouldn't be the prime minister. You think there's much of a chance of that?
I don't think there's much of a chance of that, because Netanyahu seems to have the edge in terms. I think the seats that they counted were what he got, 27, and the number two party had 23. So, you know, they have to get 60 seats to have a majority. But then there are other tricks they can play too. They can have essentially some parties who support them from outside, where they don't have to be part of the coalition, but indicate that they're going to get political support. And Netanyahu will get the support of all the extremist right-wing parties.
Yeah, certainly if it comes to either that or turning it over to Zippy Livni and them, right?
Right.
Yeah. All right, well, so I don't know. I guess over at Electronic Intifada, they're saying, you know what, so much the better, because, this is my way of saying it, they're basically saying you're better off just keeping W in power, being exactly what he is, and everyone can see him for what he is, you know, with Netanyahu as W kind of thing, right? Rather than bringing in the fresh new face to carry on the same horrible policies. And so let it be this kind of, you know, right-wing tribalist sort of a, you know, outright fascist apartheid type thing, rather than having Zippy Livni and this guy Yitzhak Herzog, who would put more of a soft face on it and a more Tel Aviv than Jerusalem face on it for Western consumption. Go ahead and let the apartheid Israeli regime bear itself for exactly what it is, led by a guy who, you know, after all, Netanyahu kind of fits perfectly, doesn't he, as the representative, as the head of state of Israel?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, there was another article out of Israel I saw today. I think it was on Haaretz, or some commentator, I don't remember who it was, said basically, well, now the Israelis have the leader that they deserve, and he deserves them. It's obviously a love fest and a perfect fit. The fascism has won,
yeah.
In effect. But it's really true. I think the retrospect on this is going to be, this was crazy. They shot themselves in the foot, no matter how this comes out. And it's, but of course I welcome it. I mean, you know, I think we have to see Israel for what it is. And I think there has to be effective pressure on Israel to change things. And the only way that will happen is if everybody recognizes that someone like Netanyahu is just an out-and-out fascist.
Yeah. Well, you know what? No more talking about Palestine, because what's more important is Iran's nuclear weapons program, Phil. So everyone change the subject. No, I'm just kidding. When we get back, Phil Jarali, more on the Palestinians and on Iran and their civilian nuclear program in just a minute. UNS.com, TheAmericanConservative.com, CouncilForTheNationalInterest.org. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. Talking Israeli election results with Phil Jarali from the Council for the National Interest, which is quite a bit different than the Israeli National Interest. You might be surprised. There's daylight in there somewhere. If you squint, you can see it. All right, so now what we've been talking about is how Netanyahu has finally backed the Israelis into the apartheid corner where there just ain't no pretending anymore. He's announced that it's Greater Israel all the way to the Jordan River, and the West Bank belongs to the Israelis. He'll never give it up. He's expanding the settlements. There will never be a Palestinian state, and he didn't really say what's supposed to happen to all the Palestinians who still live on the West Bank. But so that's my question to you, Phil. Apartheid as it is, I guess maybe it can last indefinitely with American support, but maybe not. But then what happens to the Palestinians? Because I can see where Ali Abunama and them say, yeah, that's right. It should be one state, a secular state where everybody has equal rights, and that's the end of that, right? Which makes sense. But then again, it seems like if the Israeli Zionists were put into that situation, they would instead engage in another Nakba and reduce that population right back down to the tolerable 20% level one way or the other, and another horrible massacre, and maybe the Palestinians are better occupied than dead.
Well, that's of course the question. I suspect what we're going to see is we're going to see the Israelis creating all kinds of incentives to get rid of their Arabs, and they'll be putting a lot of pressure on people like Naftali Bennett and Avigdor Lieberman have been proposing all along that Arabs be put under certain restraints and conditions, and I'm talking again about the Arabs that actually live in Israel that are Israeli citizens, that there be specific restraints and conditions as part of their ability to live in the country. So if you make these conditions more and more onerous, at a certain point, the expectation would be that they will leave, they'll go somewhere. And of course, you can if this whole situation, Israel-Palestine collapses, which it could well very well do in short order, because I think the last time we talked about this lawfare case in New York City, whereby the Palestinian Authority, it looks like it's going to be bankrupted. Mm-hmm. At that point, Israel has to physically take control of the West Bank and Gaza. There's no other way about it. And so you have, in a sense, a de facto singular state, including everyone, but the Israelis will obviously figure out mechanisms to get the Arabs out. And, of course, that could range from genocide to just kind of a more administrative ethnic cleansing. But, sure, the Israelis have put themselves in an impossible position now. And they there is no simple or acceptable solution to what Netanyahu has come up with over the last couple of days. And I don't imagine that, knowing or having watched Netanyahu now for 20 years, that he's going to try to backtrack from this. I think this is going to become Israeli policy, and he's going to be supported by the hard, hard right inside Israel on everything he does.
And then, so what are the Americans going to do about it? Nothing, I guess, huh?
Nothing. There was a, I think Daniel Larrison had a piece over Attack today where he was talking about possible consequences of this, and he said nothing will happen. The Congress is too much controlled by Israeli interests. The White House is afraid to confront that in any kind of direct way, and the media will at worst just kind of be ambivalent. It won't talk about what the Israelis are doing.
Mm-hmm. Well. Man, yeah, I don't know. It sure seems like a lot of moving parts, and you still have, you know, the West Bank and the Gaza Strip are completely divided, where Hamas controls Gaza, and they have even less rights there. I read at the 972 Mag, it was the author from there, Noam Shizoff, wrote a thing, I guess, in the Washington Post or somebody, saying that the Gaza Strip is a maximum security prison, the West Bank a minimum security prison, but that's mm-hmm. basically the difference between the two. But so,
sure.
Yeah, I mean, geez, if there's only what you're saying is, I think there's only a certain level of de facto annexation of the West Bank that you can have by the Israeli state before the pretension is over. It simply has been annexed. And then, I guess, at that point, the Americans still won't do anything about it? Or, I mean, because at that point, you literally have a situation straight out of or worse than the old South of, you know, pre-Civil Rights South. I mean, it pretty much already is that. But again, with the layers of gloss off of it.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine how this can play out, to be honest. I mean, the situation is just so bad. And there are so many genies that have been popped out of the bottle by Netanyahu in his desperate desire to get reelected. I mean, he's basically made a pact with evil. He was evil enough to start with, but he's made a pact with the most evil, the most diabolical elements in Israeli society to get reelected, and now he owes these people, and essentially there is going to be racism at a level that is unimaginable right now, and there's going to be either genocide or, as they say, some kind of scaled down ethnic cleansing. I mean, this is just it's what he has pledged to do, and what will Obama do? Well, Obama has refused to call him and congratulate him. That is probably the extent of it. They're not about to cut the money we give them every year. They're not going to stop providing them with raw intelligence data. They're not going to stop prepositioning U.S. military equipment in Israel. They're not going to stop any of these things. Now, the only light I see at the end of the tunnel is what's going to happen with Iran. If Obama is strong enough to defy the Israel lobby in this country, he'll be able to cut a deal with Iran. And that's going to cut the legs out of a lot of what the Republicans are saying and also what Netanyahu's been saying. But I'm not sure that's going to happen.
Yeah, well, what kind of odds are you giving that?
Well, I think it's almost 50-50 right now. But I, you know, having observed Obama through now 7 years or whatever, I mean, he's a very cautious player. He doesn't take risks. And one of the risks that has to be at the back of his mind is opening up the Pandora's box, the Israel issue, because there are plenty of Democrats in his party that are strong supporters of Israel, and also, of course, the entire Republican Party as a bloc, a strong supporter of Israel. So is this a risk he's going to want to take because it's the right thing to do? I don't know. I hope he will, and if he does it, he basically undercuts a lot of the nonsense that's coming out of people like Tom Cotton and Bibi Netanyahu, but he may not have the courage to do it.
Yeah. Well, it seems like, man, they're so close to it now. If they fail now to sign this thing, and it's so obvious the Iranians are willing to pretty much bend over backwards to accommodate American you know, ridiculous demands here at this point. But yeah, so, but I am interested though in, like you said, what happens if he gets the deal? Cause if he gets the deal, then yeah, he got a deal. Finally, a little political capital, right? Then everybody's got to back down a little bit.
Yeah, if he gets a deal that manifestly does what they want it to do, which is essentially deny Iran the right to enrich uranium beyond a certain point with a strict regime of inspections, it's going to be hard for his enemies, and by his enemies I mean the Israel lobby and Congress, to really go against it in any kind of positive way. They're just going to look like people that are you know, their bankroll's ghost showing up at the banquet and just to make trouble. And that I think is the reality of it. But Obama has to, you know, really has to take the bull by the horns in this case. He's got to do it. And if he doesn't do it, you and I probably 10 years down the road will probably be talking about this again.
Yeah.
Or still, and about how bad the situation in the United States in terms of our own civil liberties and everything else has become as a result of this.
Yeah, that's if I can even get Virginia on the line by then. That's outside your sector.
That's right. That's right. Actually, that movie has a lot to say about what Israel-Palestine might look like in about 2 years. I mean, you know, you have restricted areas. Wasn't there a South African movie, too, about these aliens where they...
Sector 9.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Maybe that's another way to look at it.
Hey, you know, I didn't save enough time at all to ask you about what's going on in Syria. So, right about that. There's talking about... talking with Assad and rehabilitating the al-Nusra front at the same time. Explain that, CIA man. Next time.
Next time.
All right. That's Phil Giraldi, everybody. Thanks, Phil.
Thanks, Scott.
All right. See y'all tomorrow.